This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Andy Lee Roth, sitting in for Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we discuss emerging evidence about the health risks of cell phones and wireless radiation with Dr. Devra Davis and Lloyd Morgan of the Environmental Health Trust. During the second half of the program, we talk with Dr. Keith Kilty, who's put a human face on poverty in the United States with his eye-opening documentary, Ain't I a Person? We also interview Carl Patrick and Ruth Bird with the Sonoma County Solidarity Network about their work with long-term residents of Hotel Petaluma who are resisting forced evictions at the hands of the hotel's new landlord. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacific Radio. I'm Andy Lee Roth, sitting in for Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey is in Ashland, Oregon at the Independent Media Week there, where he gives the keynote address tonight. Peter Phillips is recovering from the cold, so we wish Mickey all the best this evening and Peter a quick recovery. Today on the program, we discuss emerging evidence about the health risks of cell phone and wireless radiation with Dr. Devra Davis and Lloyd Morgan of Environmental Health Trust. Later in the show, we're going to be with Dr. Keith Kilty, whose eye-opening documentary, Ain't I a Person, puts a human face on poverty in the United States. And we'll round out the hour talking with Carl Patrick and Ruth Bird of the Sonoma County Solidarity Network about what's going on at the Hotel Petaluma in the North Bay, evictions and resistance there at Hotel Petaluma. First, though, cell phones and other wireless technology are prevalent in American life. The CTIA, the main trade association representing the wireless communications industry, estimates as of June 2012 that over 321 million wireless subscribers here in the U.S. So it's a prevalent technology, part of our everyday life. We don't always understand the risks associated with cell phones and other wireless technology, however. Indeed, the dangers of everyday technology, one of our top censored stories in Censored 2013, looked at some of the risks associated with heavy long-term exposure to cell phone radiation and whatnot, and featured information and reporting from some of our guests here today. Earlier in the week, at San Francisco State University, Ken Burrows convened a public panel on the health risks of cell phones and Wi-Fi devices. Joining us now to take us deeper on this conversation is Dr. Devra Davis and Lloyd Morgan of Environmental Health Trust. Dr. Davis is the founder of Environmental Health Trust, which is a research and education agency focused on environmental health hazards and constructive public policy. She currently lectures at Georgetown, Harvard, and the London School of Hygiene. She is the author of numerous books and research publications in prestigious outlets such as The Lancet. Her books include When Smoke Ran Like Water, A Study of Environmental Deception and Battles Against Polluters. That was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2002. Her newest book is Disconnect, which provides alarming detail about cell phone radiation and the public's health. Lloyd Morgan is an electronic engineer by training, 38 years of industrial experience. He now serves as the senior science fellow at Environmental Health Trust. Since 1995, he's been involved in the study of health problems associated with exposure to electromagnetic fields. His latest research publications include estimating the risks for brain tumors from cell phone use, an analysis of published case studies that shows systematic underestimation in those studies of the risks associated with cell phone and other wireless use. He's also the lead author of a report, Cell Phones and Brain Tumors, 15 Reasons for Concern. So welcome to the program, Devra Davis and Lloyd Morgan. So great to have you this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Devra, let me start with you. You, of course, are by training an epidemiologist, and you have described the health consequences of cell phone radiation and the radiation of other wireless technologies as an epidemic in slow motion. I assume, given your background, that you're using the term epidemic in a very specific and professional sense. Could you tell us some about what it means to say that this is an epidemic and some of the details for why that claim makes sense to you as an expert.
The word epidemic, like a lot of our words, comes from two Greek words, epi meaning upon and demos meaning the people. And an epidemic is simply an increase in a pattern of a disease that has not previously been seen. Usually, the term was developed to refer to infectious agents that move very quickly, such as smallpox or measles or whooping cough. But today we are seeing an epidemic of chronic diseases such as cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, other diseases of the nervous system. And there's growing evidence that cell phone radiation actually has an effect on the developing nervous system. There are studies indicating that exposing animals in utero to cell phone radiation does have an effect on offspring. Here in California, Dikun Lee did a brilliant pioneering study where he's followed 1,000 women who were exposed to electromagnetic fields during their pregnancy and then has seen that the results are clearly associated with an increase in obesity in the children who were exposed to higher levels of electromagnetic fields from their mothers during pregnancy, as well as other serious health problems in those kids.
Mm-hmm. Lloyd Morgan, as I mentioned, you are also working with the Environmental Health Trust. The late Carl Sagan, the astronomer, author, and popularizer of science, said decades ago now, "We've arranged a global civilization which profoundly depends on science and technology. We've also arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. This is a recipe for disaster," Sagan says. "We might get away with it for a while, but sooner or later this combustible mixture of ignorance and power is going to blow up in our faces." This seems to be what's happening with our cell phones, almost quite literally. The cell phones are having their impact. You've, since 1995, been studying the effects of electromagnetic radiation on human health. Tell us some about the research that you've done and what you've found.
There's a very large study called the Interphone Study. It's funded by industry, and it's designed essentially to underestimate the risk. The important factor, though, is that for more than 10 years of use, it showed that there's a doubled risk of acoustic neuroma and brain cancer. Acoustic neuroma is a tumor of the acoustic nerve.
So, and that Interphone Study, say some about the design of that study itself. Who did it include? Who was not included? And how might that shape some of what it found?
Well, it included people of age 30 to 59. We know already that younger people are far more at risk. But it also included a confounder, which is called cordless phones, which are certainly as dangerous as cell phones. And though they ask questions about it, they analyze it as if though it was not an exposure. That is just one of many factors that reduce the risk.
Mm-hmm. And so when that study focuses on that age range of 30 to 59, that obviously excludes children. And some of what we know from the emerging scientific consensus around the risks that these technologies pose is that children are especially vulnerable.
Children are absorb at least double the radiation that adults do. In fact, the younger the child, the more radiation they absorb. An alternate study, which is much better designed by Hardell team in Sweden, basically had an age range of 20 to 80 years of age. They also showed that if you started using a cell phone as a teenager or younger, that is less than 20, you had an eightfold risk of a brain cancer on the same side of the head where you used a cell phone.
That's an amazing figure, eightfold. And yet even that study doesn't fully address the risk to children. We know, for instance, that behaviorally phones are increasingly given to infants and toddlers as pacifiers. Deborah, do you want to comment on that dynamic and the problems there and how Americans might have a different perspective than, say, our European counterparts?
Our website, Environmental Health Trust, includes recent video where I've explained and held up a plastic baby iPhone rattle case. And on the packaging for that case, it says, "Protect the phone from the baby." It's intended for children as young as 6 months, and there are now thousands of apps. Now, none of these apps and none of those developing these things are aware of the fact that a child's brain develops so rapidly, it doubles in the first 2 years of life. And a child's skull is thinner, their brains contain more fluid, and therefore they absorb much more of the microwave radiation that's coming out of a cell phone. That is why a number of countries have now issued warnings. In fact, in Belgium, it is against the law to give a cell phone to a child 7 or younger. We in the United States are generally ignorant of this, and people are proudly giving their very smart little babies these devices, completely unaware it can affect the developing brain. That's why the American Academy of Pediatrics recently issued a advice to the Federal Communications Commission saying, please review your approach to cell phones, because when phones were first developed, they were developed for military and medical applications, mostly being used by big guys with big brains. No one ever dreamed that there would be millions of younger users with their smaller brains and less developed ones.
So a true risk that we're not necessarily as aware of as we need to be. The issue of manufacturers' warnings, I think, is a major component of all this. I think probably when I got my phone, it probably included some kind of little notice in super fine print that I don't think I paid any attention to. If I had paid attention to it, what would I have read and learned? And what might we say about, is that an adequate way of informing consumers about what they're holding in their hands when they have one of these devices?
Well, the Fox News story on Environmental Health Trust's homepage shows you that if you take your iPhone and you go to settings and you go to general, about, legal, and then RF regulatory, within your phone, buried after those five clicks, there is a warning, and it says that the iPhone should be kept at least 10 millimeters from the body. Use a headset, use a speakerphone. We at Environmental Health Trust say, distance is your friend. Remember, we are not opposed to people using phones. We want them to be smart and safer about how they do it. We think that we are now with phones where we were with cars, perhaps in the 1950s and 60s. We need to create the airbags, the seat belts. We need to make phones with antennas that work better. We need to configure the software so that a phone isn't checking every 900 milliseconds for a signal. And that can be done. Phones can be made safer. And we're actually working with some companies now that are prepared to launch innovations in this area.
Every cell phone manual hidden away where nobody reads it calls a keep away distance. That is, you cannot keep it on your body, and yet nobody knows that.
We're talking with Lloyd Morgan and Deborah Davis of Environmental Health Trust. Now, earlier this month, the FCC published a notice on this matter. Should we be encouraged or soothed by the fact that the FCC is taking notice? What did the FCC notice identify? When was the FCC notice offered to the public? And what was it responsive to? Deborah, do you want to start on this?
Well over 10 years ago, the FCC opened an inquiry, which it never answered, about whether it should change its approaches to cell phones. Now, on 3 p.m. on Good Friday afternoon, the agency issued a request for comments on a intent to ask for advice. It's a very cumbersome process. But basically, what the agency is asking is, should it change its approach to cell phones? Well, the Government Accountability Office in July of 2012 issued a report. Basically, the title of the report said the FCC needs to update its approach to cell phones. The last time the agency set its approach, which was the first time, was 1996. Gasoline cost $1.30 a gallon. The world is much different now than when cell phones were first approved. And users and uses of phones are quite different as well. No one ever dreamed you have kindergartners playing with phones all day long. No one ever dreamed that people would be giving phones to six-month-old babies. As a consequence, the agency is asking for comments on whether it should revise its standards, as the American Academy of Pediatrics has advised, in light of the growing use of these devices by very young children.
And this raises, I guess, an obvious follow-up question. Does the FCC have any competence in health matters?
They do not employ a single health expert. And the concern that many of us have is that European standards for cell phones actually allow more radiation than we do. And global trade, and standardization and harmonization, of course, is the watchword of the day. We want to have standards that are uniform with respect to worker health and safety. But if you were to have uniform standards with respect to cell phones now, you would actually be allowing more radiation into our brains and bodies than we currently have. So I'm quite concerned about this. In fact, the FCC senior staff called me at 3 o'clock on Good Friday to give me what they said was a heads up as a courtesy that they were about to issue this notice, which has been about to be issued for 2 years. I let them know that I appreciated the call, but in fact, the notice had already gone up.
Lloyd, do you want to add anything on this idea of harmonization and unpack what that refers to and how it, Deborah alludes to it, but maybe we could say more about how that works and why people listening should be alert to this terminology when we encounter it, if we encounter it?
Harmonization is a code word, which means we're going to increase the standards for the exposure limit. Sadly, but very true, the FCC, like many regulatory agencies, has been captured by the industry. Their own documentation says that the exposure limit should be as normally used. Now, if you normally use your cell phone 10 millimeters away, and we know that's not true, they've always been violating their own standards, and now they want to increase it.
Mm-hmm. If you keep a phone in your pocket, if you keep it in your pants pocket or your breast pocket, you can have 4 to 8 times more radiation than the tested levels for the phone. And that's obviously a serious problem. We see young women now. We've got 4 cases that I'm working on with physicians in California of young women with unusual breast cancers. Breast cancer typically occurs in the upper outer quadrant toward the armpit. These young women all kept cell phones right in the center of their chest, and they have tumors right under where they kept their cell phones, in the center of their chest. These are young women who are not supposed to get breast cancer at all. And we're seeing an increase in breast cancer in men as well. So keeping a phone in your breast pocket is a bad idea, but certainly keeping it in your bra is a very bad idea.
Going back to the regulatory dimensions and the FCC, Lloyd or Devra, would you rather see this issue studied by some other agency? If it's in their kind of domain, maybe it's unavoidable that the FCC has something to say about this, but are there other agencies or other organizations that ought to be at the table on this?
Well, we have to take a step back here and say that, unfortunately, the United States is well behind in the science and engineering here, and we don't have trained experts in this field. So if we were to give this to another agency, that would be a good start. But the reality is we also need to invest in training and research to provide the expertise that's needed to evaluate this. Your quote from Carl Sagan was exactly on the point. We have a situation here of such complexity that the public is easily confused. And all of us assume, as I did 10 years ago, that these things have to be safe, because otherwise why would we be using them so widely? The reality is cell phones were never tested for safety. I've documented that in my book, Disconnect. I tell the stories of how phones were approved without any safety testing whatsoever. And now it's time for us to recognize these devices are radically improving our lives in many ways, but we've got to use them as safely as possible, and that means understanding how they work better and being smarter about how we use them. You can't call it a smartphone if it kills brain cells.
Lloyd Morgan.
The United States had an excellent research program in the 1990s, but in 2001, virtually all funding was killed. The reason all funding was killed was that research found that electricity fields were possibly carcinogen, and then industry essentially put a sentence in a appropriations bill, we think there's been enough EMF research. That killed the research.
If you don't want to know, don't ask.
Obviously, this is an issue not only in D.C. and at the federal level, but it's also a local issue. And I mentioned you all have been here speaking to the public at San Francisco State University earlier in the week. You've also been involved with the San Francisco City Council's deliberations, a subcommittee, I believe, of the San Francisco City Council. Bring us up to speed on what's happening right here in the Bay Area as far as the legal regulation of these issues. Lloyd, do you want to start?
3 years ago, San Francisco unanimously passed a right-to-know ordinance, which only tried to give people the information about cell phones at the point of sale. The CTIA has tied that up in lawsuits, and now before the supervisors is to basically drop the enforcement of this bill to kill it completely. One of the people yesterday received $50,000 from AT&T as a donation. The industry corruption
here. This is one of the people who cast the vote.
One of the supervisors
who cast a vote has received a $50,000 donation from AT&T.
London Breed.
Yeah, Supervisor London Breed. And on May 7th, the supervisors as a whole are going to either go forward with this or not. I would urge anybody listening to go to the Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday afternoon, May 7th.
I think prior to that, we have to do a better job of educating the public on this issue. We're not opposed to cell phones. And in fact, the city's right to know ordinance, all it does is take the same information that you can find buried right now in your iPhone and make it available to people so that they have information before they buy a phone so they can be better informed themselves and decide what options they want for their devices. The right to know is a fundamental right to democracy. It's essential to Project Censored. How can we have a democracy if we don't have the right to know about the way these devices may affect our health and therefore have the opportunity to take steps to protect ourselves and our families? That is all this law did. It was passed in 2010 unanimously. London Breed was not a member of the Board of Supervisors that spent 2 years reviewing this law before it was passed. The case for this law in 2010 was strong. It's stronger now. And while it looks like the city may have lost in the court of law, it is certainly winning in the court of public opinion, and the industry itself is now providing information about safer uses of phones.
A quick question, and then where our listeners can go for more information. The quick question is, are there similar concerns around tablets, our smart tablets? Are those devices?
Yes, they radiate more power than cell phones, and as normally used, they're kept right on the body. They should not be at all.
They're tested 8 inches away from the body, and yet people use them on the body. So that's an example where we've got to do a better job of getting the information out to people. You can use them safely with a book or on a desk, but not directly on the body.
Good. All right. And lastly, where can people go online to learn more about the work of Environmental Health Trust?
You can like us at Environmental Health Trust Facebook page. You can join the campaign for safer phones, which is a public campaign, and go to our website, environmentalhealthtrust.org, for more in-depth information, including disconnectbook.com, all of which provides references and detailed information. This is complex science, but we are working hand in glove with experts around the world to see that you have the right to know about how to use these devices as safely as possible.
Devra Davis, Lloyd Morgan, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show this morning. Thanks.
Keep up
thank
the good work.
Thank you for having us.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Andy Roth, sitting in for Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. In the second half of the show, we go to Dr. Keith Kilty, who's putting a human face on poverty in the U.S. with his eye-opening documentary, Ain't I a Person? And at the end of the hour, we'll hear from Carl Patrick and Ruth Bird with the Sonoma County Solidarity Network about their work with long-term residents of Hotel Petaluma. But first, quickly, a Project Censored validated independent news story. These are the stories that Project Censored tracks in the independent media that the corporate media are not covering. This one is that Pennsylvania law gagging doctors to protect oil company profits. In Pennsylvania, reported by Christopher Banks of LiberationNews.org in June of 2012, a new state law in Pennsylvania required drilling companies to tell doctors what chemicals they were pumping into the ground when they engage in hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's known commonly, in order to extract natural gas. The doctors obviously needed to know those chemicals in order to diagnose and treat patients who have been exposed. But there's a catch. buried in the middle of the 174-page bill was language suggesting that because the companies deem chemical ingredients used in the process to be, quote, proprietary secrets, the law imposes a gag on doctors, meaning they're forbidden from telling anyone, including their own patients or other healthcare professionals, what chemicals were causing the patient's illness. As I mentioned, the doctor gag rule is buried. It requires professionals, healthcare professionals, to sign confidentiality agreements saying they won't disclose that information. In recent months, similar laws have also been passed in Colorado, Texas, and Ohio. So another case where we see, as we were talking about in the first half of the program, we see how there are potentially egregious conflicts between corporate interests and the public health, the public interest in protecting the public health. For this and other validated independent news stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link to validated independent news. With us now, joining us now, is Dr. Keith Kilty, Professor Emeritus at the Ohio State College of Social Work. And as I mentioned, he has created a documentary, Ain't I a Person?, intending to put the human face on poverty in the United States. Dr. Kilty, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So one of the aims, obviously, of the film is to break down some of the myths and stereotypes associated with American poverty. Give us an example of what you mean by a myth or a stereotype about poverty here in the United States.
Okay. One of the more common ideas that far too many people have is that poor people don't work, that they take advantage of government programs or make use of them and don't have motivation or drive to go out and actually keep jobs. That's one of the big issues that we wanted to try to show is very different. The people that we spoke to talked about their personal experiences going to school, trying to get jobs, trying to keep jobs, losing jobs because of jobs being moved away from their communities, from the country. And many people end up in difficult circumstances, not because they've done anything themselves to bring that on, but because of the economic structure that they're part of.
Another misunderstanding, perhaps, is on one hand, we may have greater consciousness, I think, today of poverty in the U.S. in the aftermath of the meltdown of the economy in late 2007. But I think another aspect is that poverty in America is not new, is it?
Not at all. We are approaching the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. And next January will be the anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union address, in which he declared war on poverty. And next year marks the 50th anniversary of the Economic Opportunity Act, which created many of the programs and mechanisms under the Johnson administration to try to reduce or eliminate poverty in our country. That's 50 years ago when there was some awareness of the problem. The war on poverty actually had a profound effect, which I think a lot of conservatives try to downplay. The poverty rate in 1965 when the war on poverty started was over 17%. 5 years later, it was down to just about 12.5%. That's a dramatic change in a very short period of time. In fact, it got to its lowest point in the early 70s when poverty was nearly at 11%. Unfortunately, we saw during the Reagan administration in particular, a lot of those programs cut back or eliminated, and poverty rates started to go back up into the 14 and 15% range. Dropped down a little during the later part of the Clinton administration, but then jumped back up during the Bush years, even before the so-called Great Recession started around 2008. The people that we interviewed, the individuals that were willing to share their stories with us for the documentary, were all individuals that had been struggling long before the economic crisis brought on by the banks in this country. So these are real issues that, unfortunately, many people in this country seem to put on blinders about periodically and attempt to ignore.
It strikes me that the war on poverty, this effective program, as you mentioned, a reduction of 17% to 12%, that these large-scale federal programs were actually quite successful, and perhaps the war on poverty has been a victim in some sense of our fascination with having wars on various things, most of which are not successful. The war on poverty seems to be the counter case. that these programs were successful. And I think part of what this film is doing is trying to give people a basis for appreciating why those programs have been and would continue to be so effective. One of the questions that the film asks is, what is poverty? And this makes me reflect on the August 2012 Gallup poll showing that nearly one-fifth of Americans go hungry. The specific figure, I think, was 18.2% of Americans had lacked sufficient money sometime in the previous year to buy the food they needed. Can you talk some about the relationship between poverty and hunger?
Well, there's a clear-cut relationship there. If you look at people at the bottom in our society, you know, if we take the income distribution, since we focus on poverty related to economic terms in America, if we take the actual household income distribution for the entire country and we break it into five parts, quintiles, the bottom 20% of the United States, the top of that quintile is at $20,000 a year. That means that one out of every five households in this country is living on an income, a total household income of $20,000 or less. In fact, the average for that fifth is about $11,000. That's not even $1,000 a month. How could anybody in any urban area, much less any rural area in our country now, how can any family afford food, rent, transportation, all of the necessities of life on that kind of an income? And we're talking about one out of every five people. So we shouldn't be surprised that almost 20% of the population show hunger or food insecurity or something of that sort. The numbers are very telling. If you go to local food banks, if you look at the numbers of people receiving food stamps, those numbers have gone up lately. But they've always been relatively high. We actually had to change the guidelines for eligibility for food stamps to increase it beyond the official federal poverty line because it was too low.
We're talking with Dr. Keith Kilty, whose film Ain't I a Person deals with poverty in America today. Keith, we'll have you back on the show actually next week, I believe, for a longer segment when you'll be out here in California, actually. Ain't I a Person is going to be showing, screening at Sonoma State University on April 24th. That's Wednesday at 7 p.m. in Darwin Hall 201. Dr. Keith Kilty will be there to do questions and answers after the film. And that screening is free and open to the public. So the problems at the film draws attention to the daily lives of America's poor. A last word, Dr. Kilty, before we sign off today at least.
I just hope now that people, especially as we're approaching this 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, that we can turn some attention to this problem. It's not going away, unfortunately. It can be solved. It can be reduced. We saw that with the effects of the War on Poverty. The poverty rate for children, the child poverty rate in this country was cut in half in the first 5 years after that program. We had the will to do it once, so I just hope that as awareness increases about these problems and the fact that they are problems that continue, that we'll come back with that resolve to do it again and maybe this time go even further.
And is there a website for the film where people could go to perhaps see a clip or learn more about the Ain't I a Person?
Yes, www.aintiaperson.com.
Dr. Keith Kilty, we'll be speaking with you more next week. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Andy Lee Roth. For decades, the Hotel Petaluma has served as one of the few, if not the only, single-room occupancy buildings for low-income residents in San Francisco's North Bay. And here to tell us more about what's happening with Hotel Petaluma are Carl Patrick, an activist with the Sonoma County Solidarity Network, and Ruth Bird, who's a former resident of the Petaluma Hotel and is also now active with Sonoma County Solidarity Network. Carl and Ruth, welcome to the Project Censored Show. Carl, let me begin with you. Bring us up to speed on what's been happening at Hotel Petaluma. The hotel was established in 1923, but what's been its kind of current role in the communities there in Sonoma County?
Well, as you mentioned, the building has sort of informally served as low-income housing in Petaluma, which is a small town. There's not a lot of low-income housing options in the town, so it's sort of served a crucial function. It's located right in downtown, and for a lot of people, especially people who had a hard time, who had lived on the street, you know, it sort of had served as a step up and a way to get out of that situation. And just for people in general, it served as a very convenient building, convenient housing. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful old building. It's close to everything. So that's generally what it's operated as up until recently.
So what's happened in the last year to change all that?
Well, you know, it's a long story, but the building went into foreclosure. Its previous owner, I think, declared bankruptcy, and the building was bought up by a Marin County property owner named Terrence Andrews. He took over in October, I believe. October is when he took over. He tried to raise rents on the tenants by between 16 and 18%, which at that time would have been illegal. He was notified of that and had to back down. But he announced his intentions to make renovations to the hotel, but at that time told tenants and the public that he was not going to be evicting people. In December, he told the newspaper that he was not evicting people, but 2 months later, on February 15th, the tenants in the hotel started receiving 30-day and 60-day notices to vacate. That 60-day notice expired on Tuesday, so pretty much everybody has been removed from the hotel.
So let me go to you, Ruth Bird. You're, of course, not only active with the Sonoma County Solidarity Network, but you yourself are a former resident of the Petaluma Hotel. Can you tell us some about what it was like living there and what your experience of the evictions has been?
Well, it was really disturbing. There were 104 rooms in that hotel. They varied in size. Some had private baths, some were shared. I lived there for almost 14 years, and I worked there for 8 of those 14 years. From the very beginning, from Mr. Andrews taking over the ownership of the hotel, was very disturbing to all of us. We never knew from one day to the next what was going to happen. We just knew that it was going to be unpleasant. It was clear that it was going to be unpleasant. The worst of it is that he has eliminated the last low-income housing of that type in the entire Bay Area. It's gone. Just exactly as Carl said. Mm-hmm. That most of the people who lived there were the working poor. Many were on disability. Others were retired with small pensions, which was my situation. And now it's gone forever. He can't actually tear the building down because it's on the historical building register, so he has to at least maintain the building.
But I understand, Ruth, if I'm correct, that actually it seems to be that what's happening is Terrence Andrews, the landlord, is moving in new people paying rents that are 5 and even 6 perhaps times higher than was being paid by the now evicted residents in the past.
Well, I don't know personally about that, other than that there is an elderly woman living there, and he allowed her to stay by raising her rent to $900 a month, which is, about $450 more.
Let me go back to you, Carl Patrick, with the Sonoma County Solidarity Network. What kind of actions are being taken now? Is the effort at this point to try to turn this around? What's happening in terms of activism on this issue?
Since we were first contacted by several tenants back in kind of early to mid-March, for the last month we've been really diligently trying to organize as many people as possible, both in the hotel and in the community, and we engage in a number of tactics and use, a whole variety of methods to try to pressure Terrence Andrews to, at the very least, offer some sort of relocation assistance for tenants. And also, we were trying to protect people's, right to stay in the building if they wanted to. That has not been successful for a number of reasons, mostly because of, we didn't have probably enough time. We have done pickets outside of the hotel. We had a march on Sunday with about 100 people present, which for Petaluma is almost gargantuan. And we had a big public meeting at the Catholic Church, and we went before City Council. And so we've done all this stuff to sort of draw attention to the issue. But this guy is particularly unconcerned with the plight of other human beings, and he's responded with threats, retaliation against tenants who have been organizing with us. He's gotten in our faces. He's you know, posted notices about us not being allowed in the building and all sorts of other things that I could, you know, I could go into detail for hours about. But, you know, where we are right now, honestly, is that, you know, we've gotten a lot of attention for on this issue and actually a lot of support from kind of unlikely sources. And what's going to be happening in the future, I believe, is we're going to start to gather people, have more meetings in Petaluma for the Solidarity Network. We're mostly based in Santa Rosa, but we're going to start probably having meetings in Petaluma. And we've been researching ordinances and possible ordinances to pass to increase protections for tenants in town. We've been meeting with city council members. And so I think that's probably a next step going forward, is to continue including tenants and community supporters in a drive to pass new legislation that can increase protections for tenants. Because that's really been the problem, is the city council can't do anything. No one can do anything legally about it. Unfortunately, the law is sort of on the landlord's side in this case, but we feel that morality is on our side, so we're going to keep pushing that and trying to change the situation.
I believe it was Mahatma Gandhi who said that poverty is the greatest form of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to be a case where the law, as you're suggesting, protects the property owner and leaves those who don't own property with very little in the way of rights. We have just a couple minutes left. I wonder, Ruth and Carl, if you could talk some about how people who want to learn more and perhaps get involved in supporting the Sonoma County Solidarity Network and its efforts around the Hotel Petaluma, where they can learn more and what they can do to get involved.
I believe that the answer is to change the laws that would protect renters in Sonoma County. There are none. I think that's the absolute answer to this problem. And also, please advise your family and friends not to patronize this hotel when they're visiting in Sonoma County.
That's definitely a good idea. And again, yeah, moving forward, we're going to continue a kind of prolonged struggle against this hotel and make sure that people know what's happened there. But I would say, in terms of getting involved, you know, a good place to look is just start online. SoCoSolidarity.net is our website. You can see about our group. We do a lot of organizing around workers and tenants, you know, exploitation. You know, or you can search for us on Facebook. You know, we also have regular meetings in Santa Rosa at KBBF Radio on Thursday nights. So people are welcome to come to that, get involved, you know, do a little bit of research on the Solidarity Networks. There's chapters all over the country using the sort of direct action model to protect people. And it's sort of an offshoot, at least in Santa Rosa, an offshoot of the Occupy movement. So, you know, people who have sort of been drawn to that but want to get more involved in concrete struggles in their local community, I think would be advised, especially in the North Bay, to check us out. But yeah, go online. And if you're having a problem with your landlord or your employer, you can call us. We have a hotline. It's 595-0136, 707-595-0136. You can call us and leave a message.
Ruth Bird and Carl Patrick with Sonoma County Solidarity Network, thank you so much for joining us this morning, taking time out from the struggle to help us spread the word about this important cause. We appreciate all you're doing, and thank you for joining us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. Some announcements. Things happening locally. Former member of Congress and Green Party presidential candidate in 2008, Cynthia McKinney, will be touring in the San Francisco Bay Area next week with her new book, Nothing Like Freedom. Cynthia McKinney will be speaking on Latin America, Africa, and President Obama. Your chances to see her include Wednesday night, April 24th at Laney College Forum, starting at 6:30 p.m., and Thursday evening, Cynthia McKinney will be in Santa Rosa starting at 6:30 p.m. at the Arlene Francis Center. That's 99 6th Street in Santa Rosa. All the events are open to the public as a benefit for the San Francisco Bay View newspaper. More information on Cynthia McKinney's tour is available at sfbayview.com. And finally, Dr. Keith Kilty, who we had on the show earlier in the hour, will be screening his film Ain't I a Person, a film about poverty in America today, at Sonoma State University, Wednesday, April 24th, 7 p.m., Darwin Hall, 201. That screening is free and open to the public. Thanks so much. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. Special thanks to Kirsten Thomas and Anthony Fest at the controls.